Okay, so imagine buying a single physical gold bar, right? And then simultaneously buying a single share of a gold mining company.
Right. Yeah. To you, sitting there looking at your brokerage account, I mean, they basically represent the exact same investment thesis.
Exactly. You just think gold is going up, but to
Oh.
the IRS.
Oh,
Yeah,
man.
one of those is going to cost you like an extra 8% in taxes just for the privilege of holding a shiny rock.
And, well, if you think the tax code for a physical rock is brutal, wait until you see what the regulatory agencies do to digital assets.
It's chaos.
Complete chaos. I mean, when you try to apply like 1940s securities law to internet money, the results are just wild.
Well, welcome to the deep dive. And real quick, this deep dive is actually brought to you by Cert Fuel. Like, if you're gearing up for the Series 65, they have a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend it.
Definitely. So, okay, today's mission. We are tackling a very specific, highly counterintuitive corner of the Series 65 exam.
Yeah, the other assets portion.
Right. Commodities, precious metals, and digital assets. Now, if you look at the exam breakdown, you might notice this is only a handful of questions.
It's roughly, what, 2% of the
Yeah,
test?
like 2%.
Yeah.
But this is historically where candidates just bleed easy points.
Oh, absolutely. Because if you try to apply normal stock and bond logic to like a gold bar or a Bitcoin, you're going to walk straight into a trap.
You really have to throw the standard playbook totally out the window.
Yeah, I mean, when you leave the world of traditional equities and fixed income, you leave behind all those standard assumptions.
All the stuff about taxation, regulation, basic market mechanics, it's gone.
Exactly. We are stepping out of the orderly corporate boardroom and into the physical dirt of the fields.
And the underground of the mines.
Right. And the totally unregulated, hyper-volatile wilderness of the blockchain.
And the agencies governing these spaces, like the SEC, the CFTC, the IRS, they do not share a unified philosophy at all.
Not even close. Which means we have to learn how each one of them thinks.
And to help you survive this study session, because let's face it, reading regulatory tax code is a really great way to put yourself into a coma.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to use three recurring fictional characters, right? Whenever things get dense, we're going to see how the rules hit these specific people.
I love this approach. Who's first?
First up, we have Farmer Fred. Fred is this grizzled, practical guy in overalls. He grows wheat on his massive farm and he pans for gold in the creek out back.
Tangible assets only for Fred.
Exactly. If he can't physically drop it on his foot, he doesn't trust it. Next, we have Dave the dentist.
Ah, Dave.
Dave is a high-income earner, your classic, slightly anxious retail investor. He is desperate for safe yield, terrified of inflation, and completely bewildered by the tax code.
Yeah, if there is a wrong way to fill out an IRS form, Dave will absolutely find it.
100%. And finally, we have Crypto Chloe. She's a hyper-caffeinated millennial who, like, tries to pay for her groceries with obscure digital tokens.
Right, she lives entirely on Discord and is just perpetually dodging regulatory subpoenas.
For agencies, she doesn't even think have jurisdiction over her.
The holy trinity of Series 65 confusion right there.
Exactly. So by the end of this deep dive, you, the listener, will understand exactly how the regulators view Fred's dirt, Dave's paper wealth, and Chloe's code.
Let's get our boots muddy.
All right. We're starting with the physical world before we move to the abstract. So we're heading over to Farmer Fred's place.
Right, so the Series 65, it assumes, the absolute basics here, like soft commodities are grown, right, like Fred's wheat or his cattle,
Wait.
and hard commodities are extracted, like the gold he mines. We don't need to dwell on what a cow is.
No, we know what a cow is. What the exam actually cares about is the regulatory jurisdiction.
This is huge.
Yeah. Because if Dave the dentist wants to buy stock in an oil company, we know the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, regulates that. But what happens when Dave wants to buy the actual physical barrels of oil?
Or the futures contracts based on them. Yeah. The SEC just vanishes.
They're gone.
Completely gone. They have absolutely zero jurisdiction over physical commodities. Instead, a completely different sheriff rides into town.
The CFTC.
Right. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
Oh, I want to pause on that for you guys listening because it's a massive distinction. Why the split? Like, why doesn't the SEC just regulate everything that trades?
It basically comes down to the fundamental purpose of the markets. I mean, the SEC exists to regulate capital formation.
Capital formation. Okay, so raising money.
Right. When a company issues stock, they're raising capital to build factories, hire people, grow a business. The SEC's job is to make sure investors aren't lied to during that process.
But the commodities market isn't about that. Farmer Fred isn't issuing wheat shares to build a bigger farm.
Exactly. The commodities market is primarily about risk transfer and price discovery.
Risk transfer. Okay, so Fred wants to lock in a price for his wheat today so he doesn't go bankrupt if the price crashes tomorrow.
He's transferring his price risk to a speculator.
Okay, that makes sense.
And because that fundamental economic purpose is risk transfer, not capital formation, Congress created the CFTC to oversee it.
And these transactions, they don't happen on the New York Stock Exchange, right?
No. They happen on dedicated commodity exchanges, you know, like the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the CME, or the NYMEX.
So for the exam, you must instantly associate securities with the SEC and physical commodities with the CFTC.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's zoom in on the shiny stuff within the commodity world, precious metals. The Series 65 focuses on the big four.
Yeah, and they each have very distinct personalities that drive their pricing.
Hmm.
Let's start with the benchmark, gold, ticker symbol O.
Gold is the undisputed king, right? I mean, it has 5,000 years of history as a store of value.
Yeah, it has some industrial use, some jewelry use, but its primary function in the modern economy is basically as a financial reserve.
It's the darling of central banks.
Oh, absolutely. When you think of a pure traditional flight to safety, you think of gold.
Right. And then we have silver, ticker AG. Now, silver has a very split personality compared to gold, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah.
And that split personality makes it significantly more volatile. Silver basically serves two masters.
Okay, no, so?
Well, on one hand, it has an investment component. People buy silver coins as a store of value, like a poor man's gold.
Right.
But on the other hand, it has a massive, vital industrial demand component. I mean, silver is the most conductive metal on Earth.
Because it's heavily used in electronics.
Electronics, medical devices, and crucially right now, solar panels. The whole green energy transition relies heavily on silver.
Wow.
Okay. So when the global economy is booming, industrial demand skyrockets. But when the economy crashes, industrial demand collapses, even while investment demand might spike due to fear. It's constantly being pushed and pulled. That creates massive volatility.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes total sense. Next up is platinum, ticker Plute.
Right, so platinum is rarer than gold, but its price dynamics are very different. It's heavily tied to the global automotive industry.
Specifically catalytic converters, right?
Yep, they're required by law to reduce emissions. So its fate is largely tied to how many internal combustion engine cars are rolling off the assembly lines.
Which brings us to the wild card, palladium, ticker PD. Now, let me play devil's advocate here. You just said palladium is used in catalytic converters, just like platinum.
It is.
So it's just another car metal. Why does its price chart look like a terrifying roller coaster? Like, why is it known for such face-melting volatility?
Okay, to understand palladium, you have to understand the intersection of inelastic demand and geopolitical supply chain.
Okay, unpack that.
First, look at the demand side. Automakers are legally mandated to meet emission standards. They must have palladium.
If the price of palladium triples, Ford and Toyota can't just say, well, we'll build cars without it. They have to buy it at any price. That's inelastic demand.
They are totally trapped. Okay, what about the supply side?
That is where the volatility goes nuclear. The vast majority of the world's palladium is geographically concentrated in just two places.
Oh boy, where?
Russia and South Africa.
That is a recipe for disaster.
Right. So if there's a geopolitical crisis, a war, sanctions, or mining strikes, the global supply chain instantly bottlenecks.
So you have this desperate industrial demand colliding with a sudden, localized supply shock.
Exactly. The result is massive, unpredictable price spikes and crashes.
Okay, so listener, put yourself in Dave the Dentist's shoes for a second. Let's do a quick mental check. Dave is terrified.
Always.
Right? He's watching the news. He thinks the banking system is collapsing. And he wants to buy a physical metal purely as a traditional store of value so he can sleep at night.
Okay.
Which of those four metals is his broker going to recommend? Take a beat and think about it. If you said palladium, Dave is going to have a stress-induced heart attack. The answer is gold.
Yeah, the exam loves to throw obscure metals into the multiple choice options, but for a pure flight to safety asset, the answer is always gold. You do not buy the metal tied to Russian mining supply chains to lower your anxiety.
Seriously. Okay, so we know what the metals are. Let's dig into how they actually fit into Dave's portfolio. Why would a financial advisor ever recommend putting Dave's money into shiny rocks?
The primary reason is diversification through hedging. precious metals historically serve two distinct hedging functions.
Versus inflation.
Exactly. When we experience high inflation, the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar declines. It takes more dollars to buy a gallon of milk.
Right, everything gets expensive.
But historically, precious metals maintain their purchasing power. They have a positive correlation with inflation. When inflation rises, the nominal price of gold tends to rise with it.
Okay, so positive correlation with inflation. Inflation goes up, gold goes up. What's the second hedge?
The second is a market hedge, specifically during periods of acute financial stress. Precious metals tend to have a negative correlation with equities during a crisis.
So when the stock market crashes, like the S&P 500 drops 20%, investors panic?
Right. They dump their stocks and run to perceived safety. That capital flight flows directly into gold. So when Dave's stock portfolio zags down, his gold allocation zigs up.
Textbook portfolio theory right there. But here is the massive exam trap. I need everyone listening to put a giant mental asterisk next to this. Let's look at a scenario.
Okay, lay it on me.
Dave the dentist is retiring. He sits down with his broker and says, I need a steady 5% current income to fund my golf habit.
Very reasonable for Dave.
Right. His broker says, great, I'm going to put 50% of your retirement money into physical gold. Is this a suitable recommendation under the Series 65 guidelines?
Oh, man.
Think about Dave's objective. The answer is absolutely, unequivocally, no. It's a massive suitability violation. Why?
Because precious metals generate zero income. None. They do not pay dividends. They do not yield interest. They do not produce cash flow.
So if Dave buys a gold bar, locks it in a safe, and opens it 10 years later.
It does not have baby gold bars. It hasn't generated a single penny of yield. It is the exact same inert piece of metal.
I love that. No baby gold bars. So how on earth does Dave actually make any money on it?
The return profile relies entirely on capital appreciation. The only way Dave realizes a profit is by hoping that 10 years from now, someone else is willing to hand him more pieces of paper currency for that exact same rock. That's it.
So if the exam presents a client profile whose primary objective is current income or yield, precious metals are the wrong answer every single time.
Every time.
It's just a rock sitting there. And actually, it's worse than just sitting there.
Right.
Because unlike a stock certificate, it's actively costing you money to own it.
Exactly. Let's talk about the drag of carrying costs. Mm. This is a crucial concept that separates physical commodities from financial assets.
Okay, explain that.
If Dave buys $1 million worth of Apple stock, it just sits electronically in his brokerage account. It costs basically nothing to hold. But if Farmer Fred mines $1 million worth of physical gold, he can't just leave it on his kitchen counter.
Right. It's tangible. It's incredibly vulnerable to theft. Mm. He has to build a secure vault.
He has to build a vault. He has to pay insurance premiums in case someone robs it. He literally has to pay armed security guards. All of those expenses are called carrying costs, or the cost of carry.
And those costs eat directly into his overall return.
Big time.
Now, Dave the dentist is a sophisticated guy. He says, I don't want to hire armed guards. I'm just going to buy a physically backed ETF like GLD.
A classic Dave move.
Right. I get the price exposure, but yeah. It trades like a stock. Boom. I bypassed the carrying costs. But he didn't, did he?
He absolutely did not. He just outsourced them. The ETF, GLD, is quite literally a massive pile of physical gold sitting in a heavily guarded vault in London.
And the fund managers still have to pay the vaulting fees and the guards.
Exactly. And they don't send Dave a monthly bill in the mail. They charge an expense ratio.
But how does that expense ratio mechanically work when the only asset they hold is a non-yielding rock?
This is the part that fascinates people. Because gold doesn't generate cash flow, the fund managers literally have to sell tiny fractional slivers of the physical gold they hold on a continuous basis to generate the cash to pay the guards.
Wait, so the ETF is literally slowly eating itself just to pay for its own security? That's wild.
Yeah. Over time, each share of the ETF that Dave owns actually represents a slightly smaller microscopic amount of physical gold.
Yeah.
The carrying costs act as a constant drag on the net asset value.
Okay, so whether you are Fred storing wheat or an ETF storing gold, physical commodities has storage costs. Mm. And this brings us perfectly to the bizarre pricing structures of the commodities market.
Yes. Let's get into spot versus futures and how storage costs warp the math.
So the spot price is exactly what it sounds like. It's the price you pay on the spot, the cash price today for immediate delivery.
Right. If I want to drive my pickup truck away with a barrel of oil this afternoon, I pay the spot price.
And the futures price is an agreed upon price today for delivery at a specified future date.
You lock in the price now, but the actual exchange happens later.
Now, before we get into the complex pricing curves, there is a fundamental macroeconomic relationship, the Series 65 tests here, the U.S. dollar inverse relationship.
Very important. Commodities are global assets, but they're overwhelmingly priced in U.S. dollars. So there's a direct inverse relationship between the strength of the dollar and the nominal price of commodities.
Walk me through the mechanics of that. Like, why inverse?
Think of the commodity as having a constant intrinsic value. A barrel of oil has a specific amount of energy in it. Now, if the U.S. dollar weakens, meaning inflation is high, the intrinsic value of the oil hasn't changed.
Right.
But because your measuring stick, the dollar, has shrunk, it's going to take more of those weaker dollars to buy the exact same barrel of oil. Therefore, the price of the commodity rises.
It's like a seesaw. Weak dollar means commodity prices go up. Strong dollar means commodity prices go down.
Exactly.
Okay, here is where it gets highly testable. We need to compare contango and backwardation side by side. These words sound intimidating, but they just describe the relationship between the spot price and the futures price.
Yep. Let's start with contango. Contango is the normal state of the commodity market. It occurs when the futures price is higher than the spot price.
Now, logically, if I'm Dave the dentist, why would I ever agree to pay a higher price to get wheat 6 months from now, rather than just buying it today for cheaper?
Because of the cost of carry. Let's use Farmer Fred's farm. Say Dave wants to buy wheat as an investment. The spot price today is $5 a bushel.
Okay.
Dave goes to Fred and says, I want to buy your wheat, but I live in a condo. I can't put 2 tons of wheat in my living room. I need you to hold it for 6 months.
Fred isn't running a charity. He's going to charge Dave for that service.
Exactly. Fred says, sure, Dave, but I have to store it. I have to buy rat traps. I have to insure it against a barn fire. All of that costs me $1 per bushel. So if you want it in 6 months, the futures price is $6.
The spot is $5, but the futures is $6. Futures is higher than spot. That is contango. It perfectly reflects the cost of carrying the physical commodity.
Right. And you might think, couldn't a Wall Street trader just arbitrage that? Buy the cheap spot wheat at $5, short the $6 futures contract, and lock in a guaranteed dollar.
Well, that sounds like free money. Why doesn't that work?
Because to pull that off, the trader has to take physical delivery of the $5 wheat today and store it for 6 months. And guess what? It costs the trader exactly $1 in silo fees and rat traps to store it.
The cost of carry entirely eliminates the arbitrage profit. Wow.
The market is perfectly efficient.
Okay, contango is normal. Futures are higher. It's just the cost of rat traps. But what about backwardation?
Backwardation is the exact opposite. It's an abnormal market condition. It occurs when the futures price is lower than the spot price.
Let me set up an absurd scenario for you, the listener, to explain why this would ever happen. Imagine a sudden, catastrophic global shortage of coffee. A fungus wipes out the crops. People are panicking.
Sounds terrifying.
Right. Now bring in Crypto Chloe. She's been coding for 72 hours straight. She needs caffeine today, right this second. The spot market is going crazy because there's no coffee.
Okay.
Chloe is willing to pay $20 for a single pound of coffee right now. Spot price is $20. But the news is reporting that a massive new crop of coffee is going to be harvested next year, and the shortage will be completely over.
So if Chloe buys a futures contract for coffee delivered next year, it might only cost her $5.
Exactly. The spot price is $20. Because the panic is happening right now. But the futures price is only $5. Futures is lower than spot. Backwardation.
Now, rationally, why wouldn't Chloe just wait a year and buy it for $5?
Because she needs the caffeine today to finish her code. She is willing to pay a massive premium for immediate physical delivery because of the acute scarcity.
In commodities, we call this the convenience yield. The value of actually having the physical asset in your hands right now during a crisis far outweighs any future storage costs.
It's the panic premium. So, quick recap. Contango equals normal. Futures are higher, reflecting storage costs. Backwardation equals abnormal. Spot is higher, reflecting acute panic and near-term scarcity.
That is exactly how you need to categorize it for the Series 65. Contango is storage. Backwardation is scarcity.
All right. We know how to buy them. We know how they're priced. Now let's see how the Internal Revenue Service absolutely ruins the fun.
Ah, the tax gauntlet. This is highly testable.
Yeah, because it requires you to understand what you actually own. Mm-hmm. Let's do a side-by-side tax comparison using Dave the dentist. Dave definitely wants exposure to gold. His broker gives him three options.
Okay, option A.
Dave buys that physically backed ETF, GLD. He buys it in his brokerage account. It trades on the New York Stock Exchange just like Apple. So Dave naturally assumes that if he holds it for more than a year, he gets the standard long-term capital gains rate of 20%, right?
Wrong. This is a huge exam trap. The IRS does not care about the ETF wrapper. They care about the underlying structure of the fund. GLD is legally structured as a grantor trust.
What does that mean for Dave?
It means the IRS treats Dave as if he directly owns a pro rata share of the physical gold sitting in that vault. And the IRS classifies physical precious metals as collectibles.
Collectibles, like a rare stamp or fine art. So what's the tax rate?
Collectibles are taxed at a maximum rate of 28%. So if Dave holds GLD for 5 years and sells it for a profit, he isn't paying the 20% equity rate. He's paying 28%.
The IRS looks right through the ETF and taxes the rock. That's an 8% penalty just for picking the wrong vehicle. Dave is furious.
Naturally.
So he pivots to option B. Dave says, forget the physical metal ETF. I'm going to buy stock in a gold mining company, like Barrick Gold. What's the tax treatment there?
It changes completely. Dave no longer owns a fractional share of Shiny Rock. He owns equity in a functional, operational C corporation.
Right. They have employees, heavy machinery, cash flows.
Because it's a standard business, mining company stocks are treated just like any other equity. So he gets the standard long-term capital gains rate maxing out at 20%.
But the trade-off is he's introduced entirely new risks. If gold goes up, but the mining company's CEO makes a terrible decision or workers strike, Dave's stock might go down even while gold rallies.
Exactly. He swapped the collectible tax penalty for operational business risk.
Makes logical sense. Business equals 20%. Collectible rock equals 28%. Now for option C, the wild one.
Bring it on.
The broker says, Dave, if you want pure price exposure to gold without the collectible tax, let's trade regulated futures contracts on the CME. This brings us to the infamous 60-40 rule. Walk me through this.
The 60-40 rule comes from section 1256 of the tax code. It's a special carve out for regulated futures contracts. Any realized gain or loss is subject to a mandatory blended tax rate.
Which is?
60% of the gain is treated as long-term capital gains and 40% is treated as short-term.
Hold up, let me make sure I'm hearing this right. Are you telling me Dave can buy a gold futures contract on Tuesday, sell it Wednesday afternoon for a massive profit, holding it for exactly 24 hours, and he legally gets 60% long-term capital gains tax treatment?
Yes. That is the magic of Section 1256. The blended 60-40 rate applies regardless of the holding period. It does not matter if he held it for 1 minute or 1 year.
That sounds like a massive loophole. Why wouldn't day traders just trade futures instead of stocks?
Because there is a very painful catch. You have to look at why the rule exists. Back in the 80s, wealthy traders used futures to execute tax straddles. They generate paper losses to offset income while deferring gains forever.
Right, a huge tax dodge.
So Congress said, okay, we'll give you a blended 60-40 rate, but we are closing the deferral loophole. We are going to mark to market your account at the end of the year.
Mark to market. What does that mean in plain English for Dave?
It means on December 31st of every year, the IRS treats all of Dave's open futures contracts as if he sold them at the closing price that day, even if he hasn't touched them.
Wait, if Dave buys a contract in November?
Yeah.
And by New Year's Eve, it's up $50,000, but he hasn't sold it. He has to pay taxes on that 50 grand.
Yes. He has to write a check to the IRS for phantom profits. He owes taxes on money he hasn't even cashed out yet. That's the brutal trade-off.
You get favorable short-term rates, but you can absolutely never hide from the tax man at the end of the year. Okay, let's lock this in. Listener, think about what we just discussed.
A quiz time.
If Dave buys the physical ETF GLD, what is his maximum tax rate? Give you a second. It's 28% because it's a collectible.
Yep.
What if Dave buys gold mining stock and holds it for 2 years? 20%.
Okay.
But it's a corporate business.
Exactly.
And what if Dave does a frantic 1 hour day trade on a regulated gold futures contract? He gets the 60-40 blended rate.
The exam loves to test those specific differentials. It proves you understand how the legal vehicle changes the economic outcome.
Nail those three, you earn easy points. All right. It is time to leave Farmer Fred's farm in Dave's office. We are descending into Crypto Chloe's basement.
Here we go.
Moving from physical assets with 5,000 years of history to digital assets with roughly 15 years of history. What is the overarching theme here?
The overarching theme is regulatory chaos. I mean, a digital asset is basically anything created, traded, and stored electronically on a blockchain.
And because the tech evolved vastly faster than the law, different agencies are fighting over who gets to regulate it.
Oh, yeah. The exam wants you to know the broad categories before we get into the legal fights.
Let's break them down. First, cryptocurrency.
The benchmark here is Bitcoin, ticker BTC. The defining economic feature of Bitcoin, the thing you must know for the exam, is its monetary policy. It has a hard-coded limited supply.
Right. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins in existence. Forever.
Exactly. Because it has a mathematically enforced hard cap, it's considered deflationary by design. Contrast that with fiat currency, like the U.S. dollar.
Right. The Fed can just print trillions of new dollars out of thin air, devaluing the currency.
But no central bank, no CEO, and no government can print more Bitcoin.
Okay, so that's cryptocurrency. Volatile, capped. Then we have a subcategory that Chloe loves. Stablecoins. What is a stablecoin?
A stablecoin is designed to maintain a stable value by pegging it to an external reference asset, usually the U.S. dollar, like Tether or USDC.
So the mechanism is collateralization.
Right. The issuing company claims that for every token they mint, they hold one actual U.S. dollar in a traditional bank account.
So one stablecoin always equals exactly $1. Why does Chloe need this?
It acts as a bridge asset.
Sure.
Crypto markets operate 24/7. Banks close on weekends. If Chloe is trading Bitcoin on a Saturday and it starts crashing, she wants to sell it.
But she can't easily wire that money back to her Chase account on a Saturday night.
Exactly. So she trades her volatile Bitcoin for a stablecoin. She parks her value in something stable, pegged to the dollar, while staying entirely within the crypto ecosystem.
Okay, let's do a direct question for the listener. Put your tax hat on. Crypto Chloe tells Dave the dentist that she just moved all her profits into a stablecoin pegged one-to-one to the U.S. dollar.
Okay.
She tells Dave that because it's pegged to the dollar, she doesn't have to worry about complex property taxes because it's legally considered a currency by the IRS.
Mm-hmm.
Is she right?
Yes.
Think about what gives a dollar its legal status. She is completely 100% wrong. This is a massive exam. Gotcha.
Massive. The IRS does not consider any digital asset, not even a stablecoin, to be currency.
That is a critical distinction.
The IRS is a very rigid definition. Currency must have sovereign backing. It must be issued by a central bank.
So U.S. dollars, euros, yen, those are currency.
Right. Stablecoins are issued by private tech companies, so the IRS treats them as property. They are just property playing dress up as currency.
Let's hit the last two types quickly before the regulators kick the door down. NFTs and utility tokens.
NFT stands for non-fungible token. Fungible just means interchangeable. One Bitcoin is the same as another Bitcoin.
But non-fungible means it's mathematically unique, like a piece of digital art or collectible.
Exactly. And a utility token. It provides access to a specific product or network within a blockchain platform.
Like a digital arcade token at Chuck E. Cheese. You buy it just to play the games, not as an investment.
Supposedly, yeah. Its primary purpose is functional consumption.
Supposed to be. Which brings us to the ultimate regulatory smackdown. Let's set the scene. Crypto Chloe decides she wants to raise $50 million to build a new decentralized app.
Ambitious.
So she creates a new digital asset. She calls it Chloe Coin. Now, Chloe knows if she issues a security, she has to register with the SEC, file tons of paperwork. She doesn't want to do that.
Of course not.
So she stamps the words utility token in massive red letters on her website. She sells millions of dollars of Chloe Coin to the public, claiming it's just like an arcade token.
Uh-oh.
She thinks she's safe. Suddenly, the SEC kicks down her door and slaps her with an enforcement action. Enter the Howey test.
This is one of the most important legal precedents you need to know for the exam. The Howey test comes from a Supreme Court case in 1946, SEC VWJ Howey Co.
Long before the internet.
Way before. The Supreme Court had to decide if selling tracts of Florida orange groves to passive investors was an investment contract. And that framework from 1946 is exactly what the SEC uses today for digital tokens.
Applying rules from when Truman was president to internet money. You have to love the legal system.
It's beautiful.
Okay, let's deconstruct the Howey test. There are four prongs. If an asset meets all four, it is legally a security, regardless of what the creator calls it. What are they?
Prong one, an investment of money. Prong two, in a common enterprise. Prong three, with a reasonable expectation of profits. Prong four, to be derived from the efforts of others.
Okay, let's apply this to Chloe Coin. Did people invest money? Yes, they gave Chloe 50 million bucks. Prong one is met. Prong two, is it a common enterprise?
Yes. The investors' fortunes are all tied together. If Chloe's network succeeds, everyone's coin goes up. If it fails, they all lose money together. That's horizontal commonality.
Prong three, did they expect a profit? Yes, Chloe promised it would go to the moon in her Discord channel.
Naturally.
And prong four. Were the profits derived from the efforts of others?
This is the linchpin, yes. The investors are passive. They aren't writing the code. They're entirely reliant on Chloe and her centralized development team to build the network and drive the value up.
Boom. Chloe Coin meets all four prongs. It's an unregistered security. The SEC shuts her down.
The exam trap here is the marketing label. The SEC does not care that she's stamped utility token on the website. They look at the economic substance of the transaction.
If it walks like an investment and quacks like an investment, it's a security. Let me use an analogy to really cement this. The New York City subway.
Okay.
If you go to a kiosk and buy a subway swipe for $2.90 so you can ride the train to work, that is a utility.
Yeah.
You're buying it for its function.
Right. You have zero expectation that you will be able to sell that swipe to someone else for $10 next week.
Exactly. Prong three fails. No expectation of profit. But if Crypto Chloe comes up to you on the street and says, "Hey, I'm selling these new Chloe subway tokens for $2.
Okay.
I haven't actually built the subway train yet. It's just an empty tunnel. But if you give me millions of dollars, my elite team will build the best subway in the world, and these tokens will be worth $50 each."
That changes everything. That is an investment contract. You're giving her money today, pooling it with others, expecting a massive return based entirely on her team's ability to actually build the train.
That is a security, and it must be registered.
Yep. The SEC exists to protect investors from information asymmetry. They want to make sure Chloe is telling the truth about her ability to build the train.
Okay, so if Chloe Coin is a security, what about Bitcoin? Millions of people buy Bitcoin hoping the price goes up. Why isn't Bitcoin regulated by the SEC?
Because Bitcoin utterly fails prong four of the Howey test, the efforts of others.
Wait, why does it fail? The code didn't write itself.
True, but Bitcoin is sufficiently decentralized. There's no central promoter. There's no CEO of Bitcoin. There's no Satoshi Nakamoto Inc. working in a corporate office, holding board meetings, trying to increase the price.
It's just an open source protocol run by thousands of independent nodes.
Exactly. Because there's no central entity driving the profit, the SEC has stated they do not view Bitcoin as a security.
So if the SEC steps back, who steps in? What is Bitcoin legally?
It is classified as a commodity, and therefore it falls under the jurisdiction of our old friend from Farmer Fred's farm, the CFTC.
That is wild. Legally speaking, Bitcoin is closer to Farmer Fred's wheat than it is to a share of Apple stock.
In the eyes of the regulatory framework, absolutely.
All right, so Chloe evaded the SEC by building a decentralized network, but now the IRS is knocking on her basement door.
And they want their cut.
We established the IRS treats crypto as property, not currency. How does that actually play out in real life? What is the tax reality for Crypto Chloe?
The tax reality is a forensic accounting nightmare. Because it's property, you need to know this absolute rule for the exam. Every single crypto-to-crypto swap is a taxable event.
Explain the mechanics of that, because it feels wrong to people who come from real estate.
Right. In real estate, there's a massive tax loophole called a 1031 exchange, or a like-kind exchange. You can sell an apartment building, buy another one, and defer all your capital gains taxes.
And retail investors just assume crypto works the same way.
But it does not. Section 1031 like-kind exchanges were strictly limited to real estate. If Crypto Chloe takes one Bitcoin and trades it directly on a decentralized exchange for Ethereum,
she never touched fiat currency.
Exactly. But the IRS views that as two distinct taxable transactions.
Wait, so she has to pay taxes in U.S. dollars even though she only traded internet coins for other internet coins?
Yes. The IRS looks at it like this. First, Chloe sold her Bitcoin for its fair market value in U.S. dollars, realizing a gain or loss. Second, she immediately used those imaginary dollars to buy the Ethereum.
So if she bought that Bitcoin a year ago for $20,000 and trades it for Ethereum when Bitcoin is worth $60,000,
she just realized a $40,000 capital gain. She owes tax on that $40,000, and the IRS demands to be paid in actual fiat currency.
Oh, man. Dave the dentist is having a panic attack just listening to this. Can't even figure out his W-2.
Seriously.
What if Chloe doesn't trade? What if she just mines it? Like Farmer Fred mining gold. But she uses her computers to mine crypto, or she stakes her tokens to validate the network and earns rewards.
It is taxed as ordinary income. The specific exam mechanism you need to know is the timing. Mining and staking rewards are taxed as ordinary income at the fair market value at the exact second she receives them.
So if she mines a coin, and the second it hits her wallet, it's worth $100, she has $100 of ordinary income.
Exactly. And here's the brutal part. If the crypto market crashes an hour later, and that coin drops in value to $1.
Let me guess. She still owes ordinary income tax on the original $100 value.
Yep. She would then have a capital loss of $99 when she sells it, but the ordinary income tax liability remains fixed at the moment of receipt.
That is just brutal. Okay, we have to talk about the unique risks of digital assets because they are catastrophic compared to standard equities. The Series 65 wants you to know why. Let's start with custody risk.
This is huge. In traditional finance, if Dave forgets his E-Trade password, he clicks forgot password, answers a security question about his first pet, and customer service resets his account. His wealth is safe.
Right. But in crypto,
digital assets are essentially bearer instruments controlled by cryptographic private keys. There's a famous saying, not your keys, not your coins.
So if Chloe holds her assets on a hardware wallet and loses her private seed phrase,
or writes it on paper and her house burns down,
that
money is mathematically gone forever. There is no customer service hotline for the Bitcoin network.
It's literally like dropping a gold bar into the Mariana Trench. It's just gone.
What about valuation difficulty? Traditional securities are valued based on fundamentals, right? Earnings, cash flows, dividends. An analyst can build a discounted cash flow model to find an intrinsic value.
Even physical commodities have tangible industrial demand.
But most digital assets have zero earnings, zero cash flow, and zero dividends. There is nothing traditional to anchor a fundamental valuation to.
The price is driven almost entirely by market sentiment, speculation, and network adoption.
Exactly. It makes traditional risk modeling nearly impossible.
And finally, the biggest exam gotcha of the risk section. Red alert for everyone listening. The safety nets.
Oh, this one catches people out all the time.
Let's use an analogy. Say Dave has all his retirement money at Charles Schwab, and Charles Schwab somehow goes completely bankrupt due to internal fraud. Dave doesn't lose all his stocks, right?
Dave is protected by SIPC, the Securities Investor Protection Corporation, which protects customers up to $500,000 if the broker-dealer fails.
And if he has cash sitting in a traditional chartered bank that goes under, he's protected by the FDIC up to $250,000.
Traditional government safety nets.
But what if Crypto Chloe has all her life savings sitting on super-safe offshore cryptoexchange.com and that exchange goes bankrupt or gets hacked by a teenager in a basement? Does SIPC step in? Does the FDIC step in?
Absolutely not. There is no FDIC or SIPC protection on crypto exchanges. None.
Why not? Why wouldn't SIPC cover it?
Because SIPC only covers registered securities held by a registered broker-dealer. Crypto exchanges are generally not registered broker-dealers, and the assets they hold, like Bitcoin, are not registered securities.
And the FDIC only covers deposits at chartered depository institutions.
Right. If Chloe's offshore exchange fails, Chloe gets a "we're sorry" tweet from the company's PR account, and she loses her entire life savings as an unsecured creditor in bankruptcy court.
There is no government recourse. You must know this fundamental difference for the exam. Dave gets a government bailout from SIPC. Chloe gets a sad tweet.
It's a harsh reality.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. It is time for the rapid fire recap. Let's lock this knowledge in. I am going to shout out the scenario. You give me the Series 65 exam answer. Ready?
Born ready.
Tax rate for physically backed precious metal ETFs like GLD.
28% maximum collectibles rate. The IRS looks right through the grantor trust wrapper.
Tax rate for a frantic 1-hour day trade on a regulated gold futures contract.
60-40 blended rate under Section 1256. 60% long-term, 40% short-term, absolutely, regardless of holding period. But you have to mark to market on December 31st.
The market condition where the futures price is higher than the spot price.
Contango. It reflects the normal cost of carrying and storing the physical asset.
Regulatory classification of Bitcoin.
Commodity. Regulated by the CFTC because it is sufficiently decentralized and fails the Howey test.
Speaking of, what does the Howey test determine?
It determines if an asset is an investment contract and therefore a security regulated by the SEC. It relies on four prongs, primarily focusing on the expectation of profit from the efforts of a centralized third party.
Tax treatment of stablecoins?
Property, not currency. Every crypto-to-crypto swap, even with a stablecoin, is a taxable event.
And finally, SIPC or FDIC protection for crypto held on a centralized exchange.
Does not exist. Zero protection. You are entirely exposed to counterparty risk.
Boom. That is the hit list right there. Replay that section if you need to. Now, before we go, we're going to leave you with a final provocative thought.
Something to keep you up at night.
We just spent an hour explicitly separating the tangible 5,000-year-old physical gold market from the abstract 15-year-old digital token market. We know the rules for Farmer Fred, and we know the rules for Crypto Chloe.
But what happens when the two worlds collide?
Exactly. What happens when a modern financial tech company starts issuing security tokens on a blockchain that represent fractional, decentralized digital ownership of a specific physical gold bar sitting in a vault?
It creates a jurisdictional nightmare. Who wins that regulatory fight? Is it a collectible under the IRS because it represents physical gold?
Or is it a digital commodity under the CFTC?
Or, because the token was issued and marketed by a central tech company, does the SEC step in and regulate it as a security under the Howey test?
The lines are blurring at lightning speed, and the Series 65 of the future is going to get a whole lot weirder as traditional finance and decentralized finance merge. Keep that in mind as the industry evolves.
It's going to be a wild ride.
Well, you survived the dirt, the metals, and the code. Keep reviewing those carrying costs. Remember that Dave gets no income from his gold rocks, and you are going to absolutely crush this section of the test. Thanks for hanging out with us. Keep studying hard, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.